Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Paul Feig is Hollywood's most esteemed comedy director and writer, helming such hits as Bridesmaids, The Heat, and Spy. He makes a mean martini. And he's also the best-dressed man in the Western world.
Paul, you've just made me laugh by talking about Jacob Rees-Mogg. And you're...
I'm trying to sit just like him right now. I'm lounging back.
Yeah, there's a really almost a full extension back. Sort of, but you say he gives double-breasted suits a bad name.
Yeah, well, yeah, because first of all, he's known for wearing them. And he seems to be kind of a, from my American point of view, sort of a not liked character. I mean, in the British public, I should say. And so right there, he sort of stands, you know, his suits now stand for something bad. But then they also do sort of hang there a little, slightly shapelessly, I would dare say.
It's almost like he's, they just fall, don't they, off his skeleton. There's no, but I don't know if I want to see his body contours.
I was going to say, let's be careful what we are wishing for.
I don't want to know what the real Jacob Rees-Mogg silhouette is. that might be too much.
Can't be unseen.
No, but you're looking, as always, just dapper as all hell.
Well, thank you, Sue. Thank you.
Have you always been drawn to the sort of, to the sharp and the smart?
Yeah, I have, actually. I mean, when I was young, I used to watch old movies from the 30s and 40s with my mom, you know, and you would see Cary Grant and Fred Astaire and all that. And I was like, oh, they look so cool. I always liked the way they looked. And then Groucho Marx was my hero when I was a kid, and I read a biography about him, and one of the things he said was that he never trusted a man who didn't dress well. And so I was like, well, if Groucho says that, then I must start dressing well. And so I, pretty early on, I think I got my first three-piece suit when I was 8 or 9.
No.
Yes. Yes.
So this is in Michigan.
Yeah, in Michigan.
And is it is it in a big city in Michigan? Is it in the rural backwaters of Michigan?
Somewhere between the two.
Okay. Suburban.
Very suburban, exactly. So a very blue-collar neighborhood. My dad owned an army surplus store, so he's just sold old army fatigues and sporting goods and hunting outfits and all that kind of thing. So, but he always wore a suit and tie when he went to work, but it was always like a kind of a cheap work suit, you would call it. And it was usually like a sports jacket, but they're all, you know, all completely polyester and from Sears, you know, the big department store. So I got it stuck in my head that you have to dress when you go to work, but then I wanted to really be sartorial. And so I was an only child. I was very much little Lord Fauntleroy.
I was going to say, it is little Lord Fauntleroy.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Oh, my God. My mom just, you know, would indulge any whim I had. As I want to take guitar lessons. Okay, let's buy him a guitar. Let's take, you know, I want to be a tap dancer. Okay, here we go. And this was, you know, so this was music to her ears. So we drove. We couldn't go to our local mall. We had to drive to the fancy mall, which was across town, called the Somerset Mall, which was in a more, more white collar area. And went to the Somerset Mall, went to Saks Fifth Avenue, and got a Pierre Cardin three-piece suit.
And you were 8?
Yes, I was 8. My father immediately blew his top when he saw, because he's going to grow out of it in 3 months. And I did, but oh, what a 3 months they were.
And where did you wear it? Was there no situation inappropriate for that?
No, I wore that thing everywhere. But I would wear it to like the grocery store to go grocery shopping with my mom. And all these, you know, you'd walk down an aisle and these women would just like look and laugh. And I'm just like, how dare they?
They know nothing.
Pearls before swine. But I look like a ventriloquist dummy walking around, basically. So all kitted out.
So did you get bullied at school as a result? Or did people just accept your intrinsic idiosyncrasy?
Oh, I always got bullied.
Did you?
Yes. Oh, God. Well, I mean, I walked this weird line because I was, you know, comedy guy. So I was always trying to make people laugh and trying to be, you know, everybody's pal. And so it was, you know, very affable and had a lot of energy. I always got in trouble for talking too much in class. But people liked me, but then I had bullies who just despised me.
It interests me that even though you knew that you were the subject of bullying, that you put the target on your own back. Oh, yeah. You wanted to be bullied on your own terms, yeah, because you looked good.
I know, exactly. You know, I mean, it's something I've kind of lived by, which is I want to play it safe all the time and kind of not create controversy. But at the same time, I don't want to not be who I am, you know. And so it was always that thing of like, should I do this? Should I not? And it was just like, just do it. I'm that way, you know, in life now.
Yeah.
It's kind of, even, you know, something's like, I know I'm going to create a lot of, attract a lot of attention if I wear this today. But it's like, yeah, but isn't it better to...
Be authentic.
Tell the world who you are, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But that seems to be part of the comic, the weird sort of particle in a wave that makes up the comic identity. You want to sort of be yourself, be authentic, voice your own experience, but you're also, by dint of your job, a people pleaser, aren't you? You're a chameleon. You want to kind of get as many people on board with that vision and that way as possible.
Yeah, I say, as a comedy person, all we want to do is be laughed with, but our worst nightmare is being laughed at. And, you know, it really is true, because if we're controlling the laugh, that's what we're doing. So we're trying to people please that way. Mm-hmm. But then if suddenly, you know, somebody laughs at you, I mean, I was the most devastating sound for a young male nerd is the uncontrollable laughter of girls, because you always assume they're laughing at you. And a lot of times it would be that too, but it's some weird primal thing with like nerdy dudes. If you hear, to this day, a group of women just go like just something that where they can't stop laughing, you're like, oh my God, they're laughing at me. It's the weirdest thing. It's kind of hardwired into the brain of a geek.
Is it strange that then you've made this extraordinary career in part out of giving women the potential to have people laugh at them, you know? And it's a complex brother, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
They're not laughing at them. They're laughing with them at their brilliance, at their skill.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's the worst kind of insult that can happen to a comedy person is if you make a joke and somebody goes, ha, 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 ha. But then they give you the look of like, that wasn't funny. And it's like, it's so gutting. I'm like, oh my God, like you're using laughter against me. Like, you know.
For me, it's the same, but in reverse. So if even now, as a nerdy sort of awkward child inside, if I hear groups of men laughing, I never assume they're laughing in conjunction with me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I might be completely wrong, and I do fight that all the time. It's like, they're laughing about something else. Get over yourself. See, you're not the center of everyone's world.
That's exactly it. But it is that, I guess it's our mentality of like, we're so used to kind of controlling the laughter in a situation that when it becomes uncontrollable, it triggers something in your brain that goes, oh my God, it's all pointed at me. Yeah, and then you feel like, well, what kind of ego do I have? Like, you know, they don't even know I'm sitting here.
Again, it's that thing of wanting to be the same as everyone else and wanting to be different at the same time. It's like you don't want people laughing at you because laughter is them pointing out your... Mm-hmm. The fact you're not like everyone else in their class. Yeah. And yet in your situation, you're willfully attracting that and co-opting it by wearing a three-piece suit at the age of eight.
Yes, exactly. Well, I mean, but don't you think that's why we all became funny way back when?
Still a work in progress, people. And still very much working on that.
Jury's out on me, trust me.
No.
But just because of that, because you go like, I'm going into a situation... And you just kind of like, they're going to laugh at me unless I take control of it and give them something to laugh at that I am saying, I approve of you laughing at this.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm going to try and set the rules.
Yes, exactly.
Because I was so woefully incapable of doing that when I was a kid or a teenager. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything when you're a teenager is just about... It's just a riot of hormones, and it's like I don't want to be part of this cattle market, and yet I am, and I don't, and I'm not winning. You know, I'm not the belle of the ball. I'm not going to anyone's prom. I'm not that kind of kid.
Yeah.
But I sort of want to be. So you develop, like you did. You develop other skills. You try and make people laugh, and you try and connect. I don't know about you. I connected lots of groups, so I was never. Were you fully a nerd, or were you in the bit of everyone's gang?
I was kind of a bit of everyone's thing. We were very, you know, we were. I don't know. It's funny. When I was creating Freaks and Geeks, I really was having a hard time figuring out, like, well, what are the geeks? Because I know what we were. We had nerds in our school. We had a couple of, like, hardcore nerds, like, who, you know, walked around with briefcases, and they were really weird.
Kind of Lego hair.
Yeah. I mean, just like weirdos, you know. And so we were like, okay, we're not them, you know. But then, if anything, I think we were just awkward. We were just, like, awkward and underdeveloped mentally.
I think, like, emo. I suppose you'd be what's called emo-y kids now. That kind of,
yeah,
not quite as gothic, maybe, but
yeah, I don't think we were as thoughtful as that. I mean, honestly, our only goal in life was to get to lunch, the lunch table, so we could just recreate lines from Bugs Bunny cartoons. I mean, that's all we did for years. We would just sit around and just act out our favorite lines from Bugs Bunny cartoon. It was crazy, you know. And then Monty Python, you know, eventually, and all that kind of thing. But that was it for us, you know. I mean, and just then going like, oh, and please don't let anybody beat us up, you know. And so we had no deep thoughts whatsoever, honestly, and it didn't date. You know, we're terrified of dating. I went on two dates in high school. One was I took a girl to the Christmas dance when I was a sophomore, and it was a disaster. She was a girl who, remember, there's always some couple that were just making out constantly. They were, yes, like the couple.
Yeah.
And they were so free with their public displays of affection. And this girl was part of one of those. And so for a year and a half, I was just like, wow, you know. And then she broke up with the guy.
Yeah.
And so I kind of swept in and went like, hey, do you want to go to the dance? Thinking like I was now going to become part of this PDA extravaganza. But clearly I didn't want that, you know.
No.
I would not be comfortable doing that. But I kind of thought, oh, so I took her to the dance. And she was always really pretty, but she was kind of soft and looked just like a normal girl, you know. And when I went to pick her up to go to this dance, she had done, like, crusted with makeup and done her hair up in this, like, World War I kind of
like
helmet. Yeah, totally. It like a UFO was. And it was just like, ugh, like, it was so unappealing to me because it was like, who are you? What happened to the nice, you know, just sort of soft girl next door, you know? And then she proceeded to get drunk on the way because we went with friends of hers, drove. And the minute we got in the car, they, like, crack open beers. And they're like, hey. And I'm just like, oh, you know, for me, it was so taboo, you know. And then she immediately downs a beer. She's like, oh, my God, do I need that? And downs it, which I'm immediately going like, well, fuck you. Like, you really? Is this so hard?
You have to drink yourself into this situation?
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, I can't believe I agreed to go with this guy. And then she got really drunk. And then halfway through the dance, the girl that drove us, she comes out. She goes like, Karen's really, she's really sick. She's in the bathroom and she's so sorry, you know, and she's throwing up. And I was just like, oh God, how am I supposed to? And the whole goal was I was going to make out with this girl. I was like, now she's throwing up. So I don't want to.
She's got a World War I helmet on.
Yeah.
She's throwing up.
Exactly. So then she comes back out all contrite and sad and her dress is wet. So clearly they got vomit off her dress. And she's like, oh, and so she wants a slow dance. I'm slow dancing. Like, oh God, I can kind of smell the vomit. And then we go out to dinner afterward, and then we pull up, and then she wants some. Oh, it's like, oh, so I did my first French kiss was awful, just awful. I mean, first of all, we pull up in the driveway of my house, and her friends are in the front, so they immediately start making out, you know. And I can see my father through the gap in the curtains watching TV.
Your first proper kiss, you could see your dad,
yes,
as you were doing it.
My father sitting in his reclining chair watching TV.
You'd never leave Freudian therapy if you started now.
No, exactly. I tell you, I can't even begin to start it because I would never leave there. So, yeah, so then she kind of leaned, and I was just like, this has to happen or I can't get out of this car. So, yeah, my first French kiss was awful because I didn't know how to do it, and I just, like, literally shoved my tongue in her mouth and made contact with her top teeth and ran my tongue all the way around her teeth, top and bottoms. So basically, like,
her pukey
cleaned
teeth.
Her pukey teeth, and then pulled back. And I remember she had this look on her face, I was either like, it was either the greatest kiss ever or the most horrific moment of her life because it was an awful moment for me. I was like, all right, good night. And I ran out, and then.
Did you ever see her again?
Only in school. I never went out with her again.
What's interesting to me, though, is that if she's. That battle armor, that she's scared, you know. She's nervous.
Oh, totally.
So this narrative, you know, just like, oh God, it's all me and my bad, and you know, she's probably thinking the same. She's freaked out. She's scared. It's a new person.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, and she's and she's under all that peer pressure to put on all the makeup and helmetize the hair. And I remember going as a teenager, and that would just be the alcohol's such a legal, beautiful way to mitigate shyness, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Oh, yes, totally. To this day.
I did it. I enjoyed it too much. I got to the stage where I drank my way so intensively through college, I managed to get a lot of stomach ulcers. But I think if I hadn't, I'd still be in that haze, because it's just, it's wonderful, isn't it? You can be fearless when you're dating. You can be fearless in relationships, at work.
Oh, no, totally. All the anxiety goes away.
She just overdid it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm still that way. I mean, when I get to a party, it's like somebody hand me a drink, because if I don't, I get too... I can't start conversations, you know. I just get very like, the minute I get in a conversation, I'm like, how do I end this, you know? And not like I'm not enjoying it. It's more like, I'm going to hit a point where I've run out of things to say, or I'm going to become not interesting, or I'm just going to drone or whatever. And so it's
like. But maybe the thing is, if the conversation runs drift, maybe it's them that's not interesting.
Well, I would never dare think that. It's always.
But I remember meeting you, and I remember you were dressed impeccably as usual. And, you weren't, I don't think you were talking to anybody, and we just sort of got chatting and...
Yeah, yeah.
But you probably looked at me and thought, God, there's somebody who's not, just looks socially awkward.
I was immediately drawn to you because you're just so great and funny, you meet somebody, you go like, I know I'm going to have a lot in common with that person. It's going to be fun to talk to them. That was you, Sue.
Well, I just thought, there's an old soul. with a fresh face,
in a really dumb sense of humor.
Dear listeners, the state of the world, well, it's pretty abysmal right now. But I think I found a bit of light relief that we all need. The Secret Diary of Boris Johnson, aged 13 and a quarter, is out now in all good bookshops. This tells the story of how Alexander Boris de Pfeffel Johnson, man of the people, a lazy, bumptious, entitled and overweening child, comes to decide that he should be Prime Minister. Along the way, we see him hone this technique and the persona that will one day allow him to hoodwink an entire nation. Author and comedy writer Lucian Young wields his satirical pen like a sword to expose and ridicule Boris's stupidity, abuses and vices. The audiobook is read brilliantly by impressionist John Culshaw. I'll leave you with a gem of wisdom from 13-year-old Boris. Remember, it's not lying if you don't bother to learn the truth. The Secret Diary of Boris Johnson, aged 13 and a quarter, is out now in hardbook, ebook, and of course audiobook.
I kind of guess, I mean, this is more of a formal question, which seems weird as we know each other, but I really want to know what the first film you saw was. Do you remember it?
Me just at any.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder whether maybe at the movie theater, maybe when a film that was like an event, your first like.
Oh yeah, I mean, short of seeing a Winnie the Pooh cartoon, which I thought was fantastic, but it came on before a movie called Robin and the Seven Hoods, which was a Rat Pack movie with Sammy Davis Jr. and all them, and that immediately had some opening dance number where Sammy Davis Jr. is firing a machine gun, and I started crying and had to be taken out of the theater.
No, so,
yes,
because you didn't like the violence.
I didn't like noise, like thunder and loud noises would just like really put me off.
And how old would you have been?
Oh God, what was I for that? I was probably like 5 or 6, I think. But I remember the first movie experience, like real movie experience, I think was when I got taken to see 2001. A Space Odyssey by my father and my parents, because that was back when movies were like, a movie like that was such an event.
Yeah.
And it played at like the Detroit Institute of Arts in this big thing. But so we got in there but it was all like hippie. Everybody was high, you know. You didn't realize that was the thing you were supposed to go to get high and go to. So there I'm with my parents watching, you know, 2001. And I love sci-fi, so I was like, I thought it was really cool, but then it just scared the shit out of me from the very beginning, because the thing with the apes and all the, you know, they kill the one ape and all that, and it was just like, so that freaked me out. But then there's like spaceships, so I was like, okay, cool. So I kind of enjoyed that, but also the story was sort of off-putting, and then when the guy, you know, floats away and dies, I'm just like, that was off-putting. But then that whole ending with he's an old man and then the baby, just like...
What's going on?
I was so traumatized by that movie.
How old were you then, that one?
I think I was like seven, maybe. I'm trying to think when that...
I mean, that's super young to be watching that. I mean...
Yeah, my parents always wanted to kind of expose me to things. And sometimes it was good, and sometimes it was, you know, it was like ill-conceived because I was just such a baby. I mean, everything scared me back then. I was just scared of everything, and I wouldn't eat anything and all that stuff. That's now I'm so intolerant of people who are scared of stuff and who don't eat because it's like I was the worst and I got over it, you know. So it's very judgmental. I have a real
why didn't
weird
you
prejudice.
Eat? Can you work out why that was?
I just didn't. Well,
were you fussy? Do you mean you were a fussy eater?
I was a fussy eater. Yeah. Well, one of the things was that where I grew up, especially in the you know, I was born in 62, so 60s and 70s was basically my time to become a person. Food was not great, you know, if you really think about it. It was lots of stuff coming out of cans, lots of frozen food, lots of fried food, lots, you know. And so in the part of Michigan where I grew up, food had no flavor. And I was always being told that something was great. And I had my grandmother on my father's side was the world's worst cook. But she was always presented to me as the world's best cook. And so they would always be like, your grandmother's chicken soup is the best chicken soup in the world. And I would eat this, and it had no taste. Literally, it was flavorless. And, like, so I don't know how she did it. Got just flavor, nothing. And so, but so as a kid, you're eating going like, well, this is the best that food can be. I don't like it, so I guess I just don't like food. You know, and so then just eating was always just kind of a chore. Because you just knew you had to do it. And then my mom was a bad cook too. And so, you know, she had a couple things she made that were good. She made like this beef stew that was good. And that, you know, considering the blandness of everything else around me, that had some flavor to it. But even that was kind of like, all right, you know, it wasn't until I used to say Mexican food saved my life.
Yeah.
Because some Mexican restaurant opened at the local mall called Chi-Chi's, and we went there, and they brought out, you know, salsa and chips before we started, and it just, like, my head exploded, because, like, it can taste like stuff, food can taste good.
It's amazing, isn't it, when someone turns the color up on your life.
Mm-hmm.
I too came from a very sort of suburban, gray part of sort of southeast London, and exactly the same, the food in the 70s, just brown, endless.
Yeah.
And I remember eating my first avocado and just being, what is it? Is it a fruit? Is it a vegetable? Where does it come from? And
who made
green?
This?
Yeah. It's extraordinary, isn't it? Like just one Mexican restaurant can just turn the dial.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm such a fan of religious moments. You know, because we have them. That's what forms our, you know, and it has nothing to do with religion. It forms who we are, those moments when you go like, oh, my God. You know, whether it's food, whether it's a movie, whether it's a book, whether it's, you know, a person you meet or a class you're in or something like that. And we remember those things. To me, those are like, those moments just are, they form who we are. I mean, I spend so much time, I think, unconsciously chasing after the things that changed my life in one way or another and trying to recreate them or trying to, you know, recreate that experience for somebody else. And it's just, you know, it's this kind of butterfly you chase around your whole career.
So is that what you feel your movies are, an attempt to make people feel that trill of delight?
Yeah, they really
multi-sensory
are.
Multi-sensory kind of.
Yeah, I think my, you know, the big religious moments in my life movie-wise were when I got taken, when they re-released the Marx Brothers movie Animal Crackers in theaters. And my mom took me, and it was an afternoon screening, and the place was absolutely full, this giant theater in Michigan, with college students. And they went crazy because they got every joke, everything killed. Even when, you know, somebody would sing a song, they would have fun with that and laughing at it. And I was just like, oh, my God, listen to what, you know, Groucho and these guys with this kind of mayhem they're doing on screen. Look what it's doing. And these people are smart, and so they're getting like the second layers of the jokes and all that. And you go, oh, so a joke can be smart and silly at the same time. And so that was a big deal for me. Then when I was a tour guide at Universal Studios, when I was about 17 years old, I'd moved out to L.A., and we went to see the opening show of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Ugh.
You know, and I had no idea what, because this is back when you weren't inundated by, like, lots of trailers and you yeah. know, you didn't know anything about it. So I didn't know anything about this thing other than I liked Harrison Ford, you know, from Star Wars, and that was about it. So, yeah, sitting in that theater, packed theater, The Man Chinese, and first show out, nobody ever seen anything. So that whole thing in the beginning, now that it's so iconic, and we've seen it a million times with the boulder rolling down after him when he turns and runs away from it, when that came on, I've never to this day seen an audience go crazy like that. People literally, the whole theater, people jumped up and they were screaming and yelling and stuff. And I was just like, oh my God, that's the first time I figured out what a director can do. You know, because with the Marx Brothers, it's like, oh, that's what a performer can
do.
And
a script and a, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And relationships on screen. Yeah.
They're just, he's funny. You know, like I saw Close Encounters and it wasn't a movie to me. It was like, I want to be taken away by a UFO. You know, that was, I didn't process how a movie is made. That was, but Raiders was when I was like, that's what a director can do. And that, right after that, I found out like, you know, where's a film school? And I applied to USC Film School and got in, and that really started it all for me.
You sort of said, "Oh, when I moved to Hollywood." I mean, you were young. I mean, if you say you were at Universal Studios by 17,
yeah.
When did your parents come with you, or did you just go, "I'm off"?
No, I went. It was basically I had graduated a little bit early from high school, and so I did my first year of college at a place called Wayne State University, which was in Detroit, so I could live at home because I was afraid of moving into a dorm and all that stuff. I don't know why. I just thought it was going to be people going to beat me. I was just trying to avoid getting beaten up, basically.
I'd love to have seen you in a three-piece suit in a dorm. You
know? Exactly.
Like a hostel.
There he is. Like, yeah. Exactly. Your lawyer is here. Right? But I had done my freshman year of college, and I just was starting to think about wanting to be an actor and wanting to, you know, make it, you know, I just wanted to get into showbiz. And so found out that Universal Studios was auditioning for tour guides. I called every studio in Hollywood asking if they needed actors. It was called like the main number, you know? And they're like, do you need any actors? And I'm like, well, no, we need CPAs. I'm like, oh, okay, I'm not a CPA. But finally, the last one I called was Universal. And they're like, well, we're auditioning for tour guides. And I had taken the tour as a kid. Mm. And so I was just like, oh my God. So, but they said it's in 2 days. So I was like, what? And so I had to finish my last final exam, got my next door neighbor. We got in my car and we drove straight through where I would sleep and he would drive and then he would sleep and I would drive, and got there just in time to do the audition. And I got accepted into the training program. But they said, I had really bad acne back then. They said, we're going to put you in the training program, but you have to promise that you're going to lay out in the sun every day and try to get some color and try to get rid of your horrendous zits. So, okay, sure, whatever. So me laying out, you know, I'm basically clear. I'm I have no tint to myself whatsoever.
And yeah, there's a sort of Scottish translucency.
Oh, yes. Oh, I know. And I've just spent 2 weeks in Italy, so I've got this really uncomfortable kind of color right now. It's just my body's going like, why is this happening?
You know what I mean? It's like it goes red for a while. It's you capture a little bit of radiation,
yes,
and then the body will just release it back
red,
to the
red, pink, and white.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, and then I did it for a year. I did it for a summer, and then I went back to Michigan to do my sophomore year of college. But I had already applied to USC Film School, and then got accepted, and then I moved back and never left.
But it interested me that the Raiders was the thing. I think of, you're right. There's a moment where something so extraordinary happens in a film when you're of a certain age, when you're young, when you're in your formative years. That you look around because you can't believe the rest of the audience's response. For me, it was weirdly not a film I'm hugely enamored with, but the second Terminator, when they had Arnie as a good guy.
Yeah.
And there's that scene where she's scrabbling backwards down the corridors of a mental hospital, and he turns the corner, and I just remember the whole audience going, "She's dead now."
Yeah.
She's so dead.
Yeah.
And in a modern landscape, that would never happen because the trailer would have given everything away.
Yeah, exactly.
And you'd have seen the trailer every time you open your laptop or your iPad.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas unless you were a regular moviegoer, we couldn't really afford to be regular moviegoers at the time, you wouldn't have had, you know, any intel really as to what the thing was.
Well, that's a problem. I mean, that's the big thing we always grapple with, and you know, in my business, is just like, I want people to have a pure experience, but you got to get them to come see the movie.
Yeah.
You know, because we do test screenings, you know, and those are my favorite things to do because the audience comes in, other than, you know, when they recruit audience members out in front of theaters, they're like, okay, here's the log line from the movie, you know, so-and-so.
So you give them a single, like a strap line.
Yeah. So they kind of know the genre and they know who's in it. And that's it. But that's all they get. And so that's the only time you have a pure experience with an audience because they're just like, it's just unfolding in front of them and they have no preconceived notion. And it's great because then you get a great read on it. But then you always have to kind of, it's funny, it's we movies are just built around that pure experience. But then until years later when somebody just runs across something on TV, nobody goes to a movie with a pure, and has a pure experience anymore because they've got preconceived notions. They've seen a bunch of trailers. They've tried to figure out what it is from the trailer. They've either been fooled by the trailer and think it's going to be something else and are either let down because it's like, hey, I thought it was going to be this and that's not what it is. Or they're pleasantly surprised and it's better than they thought it would be. But they just bring in all these preconceived notions and you're just kind of, as a filmmaker, you're always like, ah, shit, I wish they didn't know that that joke was coming. I wish they didn't know that this thing was coming.
Yeah, they do spaff a lot of good jokes on trailers now.
Yeah, well, what I always have done with my movies is we shoot so many alternate jokes that I always tend to say, like, put in all the jokes that aren't in the movie.
That's great.
Right when I have a deal with marketing. Like, as we're shooting, I just feed everything we're shooting to marketing. Because a lot of times filmmakers are like, yeah, they can't see it till I control it. It's like, give them everything, you know, because they'll start pulling out jokes. And a lot of times they'll send me kind of early trailers and stuff, and they'll find jokes that I didn't even think we had or forgot about. I was like, oh, cool, that's great. And then it's like, okay, well, you keep that, and we're going to put it in the movie, or, you know, or let's trade that, or just use that for the movie. And so that's what's really fun, is like if people think they know all the jokes, and then they show up. But then sometimes they're like, oh, what happened to that joke? I was looking forward to that thing. So you can't keep everybody happy.
I've just thought there's an image in my head which is now really making me laugh, which is thinking about your experience kissing a girl who's been cleaning, basically being the dental hygienist of a vomiting teenager. Makes me think, of course, of Bridesmaids, of vomiting, a cabal of vomiting women.
Yes,
exactly. And you've ended up sort of,
it all comes full circle.
Yeah, it's strange that, isn't it, that it's but this smash hit features women who've just gone out, got blind drunk, who I suppose they're not copping off. They're celebrating a sort of, you know, an imminent union, but
yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, for us that scene was always it was the catalyst of it is what, how do you handle when you've made a mistake and in the face of overwhelming evidence you pretend that it didn't happen.
You double down.
Yeah, exactly.
British politics in a nutshell.
Yeah, there you go. Yes, exactly. American too these days. Oh, God. But, you know, so that just was funny to us of like, you know, she doesn't have money. She's trying to compete with this woman who's got more money than her and is more everything than she is. And so she takes somebody to like a shitty restaurant, passes off it like it's a great restaurant. And then everybody gets food poisoning from it. But her thing is like, everybody's fine. I'm fine. You know, and then the comedy comes from the overwhelming evidence of like, no, clearly nobody's fine. They're shitting in sinks and they're throwing up on each other's heads and taking a dump in the street. You know, but to me, the whole, that scene, the glue of that scene is Kristen and Rose Byrne's standoff.
Yes.
Where she's not going to throw up and she's sweating. And you know,
the sweat is, we've just talked about this before, the increased amount of sweat on Kristen's face destroys me every time I see it.
That's the genius of Kristen Wiig. I mean, she was just like, she, you know, we were doing, she goes like, hand me that can. So we had that little Evian, you know, spray can or whatever, moisturizer. And she just would, she'd say one line and then she'd take the thing and spritz your face once, put it down, say the next line. So then each time we cut back, it was just wet. And it was, oh my God, she's a genius.
She is a genius. I mean, let's talk about that, how that happened. I know you, after Freaks and Geeks, and you know, which Time magazine listed as one of the top 100 TV shows of all time.
I know, it's fantastic.
But it's that can be sort of scant comfort because at the time, you know, you were treated pretty poorly. You know, it got one season and they canned it.
Yeah, no, we were definitely the bastard child of that network. It was our timing was really bad because game shows had just taken off. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Thank you, Britain, for that.
You screwed Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah, I totally did. I mean, because that was, you know, all the networks were seeing that their top-rated show, the top-rated show on TV cost a fraction of what, you know, doing a dramatic show would be. And so, in everyone's defense, our show was always one of the lowest-rated shows on NBC.
But there should be, I mean, I suppose now it's easier, but there should always be a sort of a broad ecosystem where different things can flourish at the same time.
Yeah, it's a little different today because the minute they started putting out shows on like box sets and DVDs, like a season out,
you could
get another season if you were really well received. Critically received. And we were really critically received fantastically. It was crazy. And so that normally would have gotten us to another season, but this was before they were doing that. I've been coming to the UK for years and years and years, and I was always obsessed with the way that the Brits would do it because, you know, I could go to HMV or whatever it was at the time, and I could buy any TV series I wanted. You know, I just come back with mountains of videotapes, you know, and just catch up on all these British shows. And I was just like, why don't we do that in the States? Why don't we have access to that? But it was because they all wanted to just get to a point where they could syndicate the shows, and they'd make all the money by then running, you know, reruns and all this thing. So they never did it. And so when Freaks and Geeks got canceled, it was one of these shows that everybody's like, I hear that show's great. And it's like, well, yeah, but it's gone now, so
there's no way of seeing it.
You can't see it.
You just can't see it.
No, and so that was this devastating thing when we got canceled. Like, we did this, I considered it, you know, really fine work, and now it just doesn't exist anymore.
Fine work that broke, you know, new talent, fresh new talent, that had a real take on that awkward adolescent, painful adolescent experience.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's sort of, what happened after that? Because I suppose the next thing that people would remember you for, if you were going on a pure, like, hardcore IMDb vibe,
do it, man.
Would be like maybe Bridesmaids.
Bridesmaids, yeah, that was the next thing that kind of made a splash.
So there's like a 10-year intervening gap, isn't there, or something? Okay, so what happens there to the impeccably dressed Paul Feig in Hollywood?
Well, it's funny, after Freaks and Geeks, it was so well received that in the industry, everybody like wanted to do my next thing, you know? So it was just like, what do you have? So I went around pitching, you know, I pitched this show called Ludlow Residence, which was based on I grew up next to a family of 8 kids and I was an only child. They were my best friends. And so I thought, oh, I want to do my take on a big family show. And so wrote this, and there was kind of a bidding war over it. And then Fox picked it up, Fox Network. But then it just kind of languished, and they didn't end up making it. I was really proud of it. I was really happy with it. But they just didn't want to do it for whatever reason. And then I was just trying to develop and kind of couldn't get anything made. And so I just started directing TV because I had gotten a call from our line producer from Freaks and Geeks. He was working on Arrested Development. And he said, they really like you over here if you want to direct one. So I went in and, you know, lucky because it's a brilliant show. So I started doing that, and I just started directing television, which was fun. It was good for me because since I had run, you know, since I had created Freaks and Geeks and had, you know, run it with Judd, I wasn't just like a TV director. So I would get the extra thing of any show I'd work on. They kind of like, oh, you know, come into the writer's room. I could have input on the script a little bit more, not a ton, but more than most TV directors. You just show up and you just kind of, here's your script, do it. So it was nice. It was really good. But I always referred to that 10 years of my life as running down the clock. Because I was like, because I had made this movie in that time. I made a movie called I Am David, which was hugely unsuccessful. I mean, like, it cratered. I think it got released. It got released here. I think it made £6,000 here.
Whoa.
Yeah, I mean, just awful. I mean, and I'm proud of, you know, you love all your babies. But it was more of a drama about a kid growing up in a communist labor camp, and he has to escape and get
all
across
the laws.
Europe. Yeah,
all
so
the
I mean,
laws,
exactly. But it was based on a book that I was told was every kid in all of Europe had read in school, called I Am David by Anne Holm. And then
I've heard of it.
Quickly found out that it seems that nobody read the book.
6,000 people have read it. That's what we know now.
Each paid a pound to show up.
Your achievement is we've isolated the readers of that primary text.
We got one theater they're all going to be in, and then take your movie and get out of here. So that had bombed, and then I made another movie, within that 10-year period called Unaccompanied Minors, which was a Christmas movie, ironically, since I just made a Christmas movie. And that bombed too. And so I was in what is called movie jail, which means you can't. Nobody's going to hire you to make a movie.
How many bombs before you get to movie jail?
For me, well, one studio. Because my I Am David kind of didn't quite count on my ledger because it was an indie and sort of
art housey and
It flew under the radar. But this one was, you know, it was a big Warner Brothers thing and it didn't make money. And so, yeah, so that was it. And yeah, and then, so I was just, yeah, I would go, I'm kind of just running down the clock. I was working on some of the greatest shows. I mean, The American Office, Arrested Development, Mad Men, 30 Rock, all these, you know, I directed on all these really great shows, Nurse Jackie, but it wasn't mine, you know, and so I did a really good job, I felt, it, you know, directing other people's stuff, but it was just like, I'm not telling my stories and I'm not getting to do the stuff I want to do. And was really when, like, okay, I'm just going to kind of, I'll make enough money to live on doing this, and then I'll be old and I'll die, you know, my wife and I'll have a nice life and all that. So when Bridesmaids popped up, and it was really Judd, you know, I mean, you know, Judd, we knew each other because of Freaks and Geeks, obviously, and, you know, he sought me out because he knew I loved, you know, working with women and having female characters and all that and telling these stories. And so, you know, he called me and had me come to a table read of that. But it was like 3 years before it actually got made. And I was just finishing up on Unaccompanied Minors. It was yet to bomb. And went to this table read. And here's all these great women at this table. It wasn't even the cast that we had. But Melissa was there. But I didn't know Melissa at the time. She was reading different part.
Oh, was she?
Yeah, yeah. She was just kind of like a utility player at this read. And but I'm just going, oh, God, this... Here's a chance, you know, the script needed a ton of work, but like, here's a chance to have, you can put all these funny women into a movie.
To get it on the ground.
Yeah. But then it just kind of went away. It was like, Judd, you know, I was busy with my movie and he wanted me to shepherd the script, but, you know, kind of for no money. And I was like, I can't do it now. But we gave notes. I was like, just keep me in mind for it. And then 3 years later, it suddenly popped up out of the blue. And Kristen was nice. And, you know, I went and talked to Kristen and she was nice enough to want me to do it too. And, you know, then we did it, and it just changed everything.
And how, I mean, the script had presumably have gone through various evolutions. How much further work did you all do on it as a cast and a crew?
We did a lot, because it hadn't changed a ton from the 3 years prior. They had kind of done back and forth and stuff, and some other people had gotten involved and left. So it was really, you know, Kristen and Annie and myself and Judd, and we had a few other writers who kind of had a room going. And Kristen was off in New York doing Saturday Night Live, but Annie Mumolo was with us. And so we were kind of all working on stuff, and then she would send it back to Kristen, and then they would work on it. And send it. So it was an intense kind of three or four months of just really being hard on the script. You know, but always making sure that it was running through Kristen and Annie's, you know, typewriters. And yeah, so, but, you know, when we went into production, we had a lot of script.
And did you get, I mean, we've talked a lot, about the kind of incel disapproval at women, kind of women kind of owning and kind of anchoring movies. But I don't know, you don't see your films quite rightly as sort of female movies, but did you, as you were making Bridesmaids, think that this is going to slightly reinvent the wheel? Did you have that sense, or was it just another day at the office?
It was. I mean, it was weird. It was to us that we just want to make a funny movie, and I was just excited because I could hire all these really funny women, and I definitely had not been happy with the way women have been portrayed, especially in comedy, for years and years and years. You know, they were just always, you know, either just, you know, a foil, or a, you know, the person getting in the way of the funny guy, or
warm props.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like the shrewish girlfriend or whatever, you know. And so that was exciting to me. But then, yeah, it was just like, let's just make a funny movie that we can all relate to. But then it was more that the town started talking, because a lot of female writer friends who were so inspired that we were doing this, that they kind of saw, oh, good, we can make more female-led movies, because it was really hard to get a female-led movie made. It, you know, it's gotten better, but it's still not the first, you know, it's not the default setting of Hollywood still. Mm. And so they would tell me, like, they'd go out and pitch a movie, And the executives would say, well, okay, well, we got to wait and see how Bridesmaids does. So then it's was like, oh, my God.
The pressure of that.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. Also, that just shows how stupid the town is, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, because not like, you know, when they're making The Hangover, it's like, oh, well, don't pitch movies with three guys in it. Yeah. Because if that
no more buddy
well.
Movies, guys. We need to see how The Hangover works.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because then we can't make movies with guys in it anymore. So yeah, it's so ridiculous. But, yeah, but you definitely start to feel that pressure. You know, but we put it together the way we'd normally do a movie and just tested it and, you know, worked really hard on it. But then it was when we were going to open. That was when it was scary because then I was told through Judd had heard through this, said the studio, I think the studio had said this to Judd that, like, if the movie didn't make $20 million or more on the opening weekend, it was going to be considered a failure. Which, and I was just like,
that's
oh.
the spirit, guys.
I know. And so I was like, oh, God. But I don't know. You know, you make a movie, go like, well, maybe we'll make $100 million. I don't know. You know, but then tracking starts to come in. You know,
what's tracking? What's
tracking is basically where they just through a series of science that they have through movie theater owners and through polling and just talking to people on the streets, find out, like, if people are aware of a movie, how aware of it they are, what their interest in seeing it is. And so there's all this data that comes down. Like, they have definite, you know, 10% of the people have definite interest in this. And it just goes down. So they scientifically can, it's so annoying because they basically go, they can tell you how much money your movie's going to make through the course of its life.
And are they accurate with their predictions?
They're many times annoyingly accurate. Sometimes they're wrong, but more often than not, so when you get the number, you're like, God damn it, really? Can it be higher than that? The simple favor was that. I was like, God, fuck you guys. You know, they're like, it's going to make between $40 and $50 million of theaters. All the theater owners said, like, how dare you? And then they made right around. They made like a little over 50. So, okay. But I remember getting the call that morning because they had done midnight shows. That's the thing they do now. They do like the night before opening night, they'll do these advanced screenings and they kind of test the water through that. So, but this was a wedding movie. And so they did this midnight screening. Nobody knew. So it didn't do that well. So they're like, okay, it's going to make $13 million. So I remember getting this call from my agent. I was sitting on the toilet. I hold nothing back. I remember getting this call on the toilet that morning. He goes, like, it's going to be 13. I was like, oh, fuck, are you kidding me? And he's like, yeah.
In a way, you're in the perfect place.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I was just despondent all day, just walking around like, God damn it. And also that feeling of, like, I guess now women don't get to make movies, be in movies anymore.
Yeah, what did you say? You're the one that they're going to hang everything on. It's too much responsibility. So they said $13 million for your opening weekend.
Yeah, 13 in the morning. But then, so, you know, walking around in a haze, and then kind of come mid-afternoon, they're like, well, actually, it looks like it's going to be like $15 million. Like, oh, that's still not good. And then, but then the calls kept coming in like every hour. Like, well, actually, they're thinking $17 million now, you know. And then, because these afternoon shows were doing really well. And then I had Melissa McCarthy and her husband Ben Falcone come to our house because they live in the neighborhood and we're friendly, and said, let's just come over for dinner and we'll kind of, you know, commiserate or see how the night goes. And as we were at dinner at our house, text started coming in, like, it's actually gonna be 19, it's gonna be 20, it's gonna be 21, it's gonna be 22, you know. And suddenly it was gonna be like $24 million, and we're just like, oh my God. So we, like, get in the car. So we all got in the car and drove down to the Arclight Theater in Hollywood and walked into this packed theater that was just like rocking, and just every laugh was huge, and we're just like, oh, it was the greatest, turned into like the greatest day of my life.
I mean, obviously, I don't know much about the process of directing a movie, but the fact that you're getting almost real-time updates from Money Men about how your film is projected to be doing is extraordinary.
Oh, it's crazy. But, you know, then the opposite side is, you know, if it's not doing well, the calls suddenly are gone, you know. I mean, that happened with Ghostbusters is, you know, they were the head of marketing or whatever called, okay, well, it's looking like it might, you know, they wanted it hit $60 million
on an opening weekend.
Yeah, okay. Because it was an expensive movie. And, you know, I really thought we could too. But, you know, says, okay, it's looking like we're going to get hit there. And then I got a report from somebody else of, like, it's actually looking like it's going to be more like the high 40s. And then nobody ever called me again.
And what did it do in the end? What was it?
It ended up having a $46 million opening weekend, which was not enough for, you know, it was my biggest opening, but it wasn't enough for the budget but that it carried.
But it recouped. Presumably, they're wanting to get certain multiples of their budget back.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
It's not about breaking even ever, is it?
No. And it actually, I mean, theatrically, it lost money. But then,
did it?
Yeah, it did. We didn't do well.
It gross like $288 million or something? Like
yeah, we were more like $230 million or something. Okay. But you know, our budget was like $140 million or something. So you know, you have to double it. So but look, I'm sure they've made money back now with all the other ancillary markets, as they call them, and, you know, DVDs and all that stuff. You know, and I'm hugely proud of it. But we just had, you know, there was just so much bad press about us just, you know, for 2 years leading up to the movie because of all the, you know, the outrage on the internet.
Well,
and how dare
you've taken their sacred artifacts.
Yes.
It's the sacred things of childhood.
Who knew? Who knew that it meant so much?
I don't think they knew it meant so much.
No.
They were entitled to a reactionary opinion, having not seen it.
Yes, God forbid if we put girls in their movie.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about that before. We talked about how freighted that movie was with all kinds of sort of toxic response. Mm. A lot of it sort of racist and misogynistic and possibly homophobic in nature. What, you know, you're a well-mannered gentleman. I mean, having that bombardment of pure fury must have been pretty tough.
It was tough, especially, you know, growing up as a bullied kid, you know, you kind of go, oh, I'm an adult now. Now the bullying stops. And it had stopped for a long time. I always had this really nice relationship with the internet because of Freaks and Geeks and Bridesmaids.
Because you're one of them. And
Totally. I'm a nerd like you guys. Yeah, exactly. And so I just wasn't prepared for what I got hit with, you know, for that much bile coming at me, because I every time I announce a project, everybody's all happy. So this one's like, hey, I'm gonna do, you know, Ghostbusters, but I do it with hilarious women. That's who I'm gonna call. And you know, the first day is kind of all the responses are coming in, people are excited and happy and that. And then the next day it went out to all kind of the portals that would be outraged, and just within a day, my Twitter feed just turned into hell. And I just wasn't prepared for it. Like, now it wouldn't throw me, because I've been through it.
But how awful, though, that you're sort of inured to it now, that you can take
a
level of abuse.
Yeah, but all of us, we all get it. I mean, and the internet is sort of the best thing and the worst thing that ever happened to mankind.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm glad we have it, because it's really connected us so much. But it just makes every voice equal, which, yay, people, but at the same time, not so yay sometimes. Because there's some really, really scary people out there. And also, people just, the most boring human emotion right now, away from needing it to make real change in society, is outrage.
Yeah.
You know, legitimate outrage is great, but there's so much just wasted outrage that it's just so boring. I mean, people, anything you put up, somebody's going to get outraged about something. And it's so dumb. I mean, you know, having gone through the Ghostbusters thing, look, I get it. I'm very, you know, religious about my favorite movies and all that. But at the same time, like, to get death threats about a movie about funny people catching ghosts, like,
that no one's ever seen, that people hadn't seen at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, it's theoretical outrage, isn't it? It's not it's not based on fact or evidence. It's not having gone to a movie theater and my childhood's destroyed thanks to Paul Feig.
Yeah, exactly.
They've got a bit of news come through their social media feed and they've connected through their tribal affiliations to a sense of rage that to a notion they've been fed about women taking over the world and, you know, the white man, there's no room for us anymore, and all this shit.
Yeah.
It's just, I always encourage people who go down that road to just, you know, I don't know if it's the same in the States, but we do a census here, which tells you exactly the demographics of your local region. And just anytime someone goes, we're being overrun, just go and click on that. This is a factual document produced by our unelected government, and it will tell you we're not being overrun.
Well, that's
it's
the
just
human
fear-mongering.
Brain. Well, totally. You know, I'm a big Richard Dawkins fan, you know, and he would talk about how the brain, you know, the human brain is kind of can't comprehend large numbers, you know, because it's outside of our scope. And that's exactly what you're talking about. Like, you know, that's the problem with the internet too, is that you know, you open up your feed and like, oh my God, the world's against me. I, you know, and you're like, well, that's like 100 people. But to us, it's that's all you can see, you know.
It's totality, isn't it?
Yeah.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. Yeah. And that idea of people, if you because you like this, you'll like this.
Yeah.
That's how people are finding their social groups as well. It's like, okay, we're a crew.
Yeah.
And because we hate this, we hate this.
Yeah.
And they're mobilized. And then they... But I it's interesting. I suppose people wouldn't think, you know, you're an extremely articulate, successful writer, director, performer. People wouldn't think that you could be destroyed over your cornflakes by a random. But you can.
Oh, you know. I mean, it's like you can get a thousand compliments and one person says something mean and that you just obsess on that.
Yeah,
and
that's the day.
And I go, and that's why... Those are the moments I go, like... Is the internet really a good thing? You know, or at least social media, let me say it that way, because of that. But I mean, that was the mistake I made during the lead up to the Ghostbusters coming out was I always had this thing about, like, I will never block anybody. I want to read everything. If somebody has a problem, this and that, I want to know all of it. And so... So that was me, you know, for the 2 years leading up to, or 3 years leading up to Ghostbusters, really, was just reading endless amounts of just bio.
Was it that long? 2 years? For 2 years in advance, you were
Because I mean, it was, because I announced it, I guess it was 2 years from when I announced it to when the movie came out.
Oh, man.
And then, you know, then after that. You know, and so would read all this stuff, and it just would knock you down. And my big mistake was there was some guy in outside of London who just was my main tormentor. And he only had like 96 followers, but he would just, and he just got under my skin and under my skin so badly. And finally, I was on vacation after we had wrapped production on Ghostbusters and filming on it. And I'd been so good the whole time, just being positive and putting out all this stuff. And this, he got me at this one moment. I'd had some wine. I was sitting with my wife in this beautiful setting. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to tell this guy to go fuck yourself. And I typed this thing at him and, like, you know, basically, like, fuck you. And much more erudite.
There were adverbs in there and everything.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. There's actually sentences. But, and I, my wife had gone to the restroom. She came back and she goes, like, why are you smiling? I said, like, I feel so good. I finally got it off my chest. And she's like, should you have done that?
And yeah, Laurie's immediately like, let's damage limb limitation then.
Totally. I'm like, don't worry. This is great. And then like, I got an email from Judd like, hey, I don't think you should have done that. And I was like, nah, this guy's been up my ass, blah, blah, blah. All, you know, he represents all these people. And then, of course, it was a disaster because basically, you know, it's, do you ever watch professional wrestling here? You know, it's always like the guy comes, the most powerful guy comes out, he's, this. And then they hit him with a chair and then he's like on the ground, like, oh, all hurt. And, you know, and he can't get up. And that's what the mean community online is like, they can fire at you the minute you fire back. Oh my God, we're
they'll claim a power dynamic.
How dare you?
Yeah.
How you monster? And that's, you know, so that's I now anybody involved in a big project like this, I'm always like, don't respond.
But yes, I mean, that's very frustrating because you're not allowed to have a human response. You have to have this sort of the corporate line.
Yeah, exactly.
And what do you do? I mean, some people, I suppose, just don't have social media accounts. But I suppose you do. But also, for you, you're still in that movie theater looking around at the audience laughing at animal crackers.
Yeah.
And you still want to know what everyone thinks. That's why you test screen. That's why
you...
And the guy outside London who's raging, there's a part of you that wants him to be, you want him to be happy.
Totally. Oh, no, totally.
You want him to laugh at your joke.
Yeah, because then I start going through their feed. What do they like? Oh, yeah. God, it's this though. I like that stuff too. So why are they mad at me? You know.
But what is that? Why do we obsess over the people that hate us and not spend enough time with the people that love us?
Because that's why we're in the business. We're people pleasers. I mean, this is why we do
comedy. All the time.
We're fucked up.
We're totally fucked up. But it's like we're trying to convert people who have a natural antipathy towards us to what? The cult of us? We're not. Narcissistic nightmares.
Well, that's all, but again, not being able to comprehend numbers. It's always when I'm like driving through a city or flying somewhere and I look down and you just see all these, you know, towns and stuff. And you go, why do I care about one person? You know, it's not even a drop of water. It's just, but that's my problem with social media, is it makes everything seem as important as the other thing. And again, but look, we're in a commercial business. Like, I'm not a painter. You're like, all right, make a painting. I don't care if you like it or not. Like, I'm making commercial movies. You know, studios are entrusting me with millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah.
I got to deliver the goods, and I got to make sure that we can hit as many people and make as many people happy as possible. That's why I'm obsessed with these test screenings, because, you know, it's very democratic, or representative, I should say, because, you know, people always say, well, just one audience, what do they know? If you recruit people off the street, you know, the way that they do it and get the demographics and all that stuff, you get a pretty good sense from one theater filled with 400 people who don't know each other what 4 million or 40 million people are going to respond.
Yeah, it's weird that, because I would have said you can't extrapolate from a particular region, but you've always said, yeah, that it's actually, that America's pretty culturally cohesive and that you can kind of work out what the entirety of the nation's going to think.
Yeah, no, that's why they can call an election after, like, 1% of the votes have been tallied, because they just kind of, it
rolls out.
Yeah, you know, occasionally you hit a thing where, like, oh, there's a pocket of this and that, but, you know, for our purposes, you know, sometimes we're like, oh, screw that. You know, especially if there's something you go, I know this works. Like, something's like, well, maybe, but I'll go, well, let's just test it again. But if we do it in front of like two or three audiences and it doesn't work, I'm like, get it out of there, because for some reason, something's not right about it, you know, or something's not working.
I know you're writing a monster movie. Can I say that?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm so excited about this. I love a monster movie.
Yes.
But is it good to be back at the desk and scripting again? I mean, I know you've obviously written films and co-written films, but there's got to be such a sense of freedom and control, you know.
Yeah,
authoring your own.
Well, but once I finish production on the movie, I'm usually like ready to go back into just managing myself, you know, because the movies, you're just working with so many people, and it's great, it's so much fun. But, you know, there is something nice about then the writing and get there. But then once I'm writing, then I'm always like, you know, okay, I want to get back to the, I never want to be doing what I'm doing, is basically what it is.
But I think that's the creative brain, isn't it? It's just distracted and always just delighted by the other, and doesn't, you know, I'm the same. I don't want to sit on my own and write, and yet that's all I want to do when I'm suddenly on a, you know, on a show and everyone's chatting down my ear, or, you know, whatever they're doing, you know.
Yeah, totally.
And, I know you like, there's sort of every genre needs to get the Feig treatment. But
working my way through them.
We discussed a musical. I would love to see you do a musical.
Oh, that's one of my things I'm dying to do. That's probably the genre I'm the most desperate to do and do right. But I just want to, it's got to be really good, and it's got to be unique. And I'd like it to be an original musical.
Yeah.
I'm not really drawn to doing like kind of a pre-existing one, unless something popped up that I'm not thinking of. But the idea of doing an original musical would just be so much fun. And my company, I've been developing one for a while now. We've never quite got it right. And now I don't know if I want it to be that. I might want it to be a little bigger in scope. I like spectacle.
Yeah, Busby Berkeley.
Yeah, and color. And, that's what I love about this new movie, Last Christmas, because it's just fun to look at, you know, because we just showed off London so beautifully, and it's Christmas time, so all these beautiful colors.
It does look incredible.
It's really pretty. It's a very pretty. It's the prettiest movie I've made, and I really like that about it. That's what I want with a musical. You know, that's my wife, Lori, who you know, is obsessed with Bollywood, as you know.
Yes.
And but I love watching those movies. I love them. I like those movies a lot. But what I love are the musical numbers, the dance numbers, because they're just so fun to look at, and they shoot them so great, and the colors and the dancing is so fun, and I don't think anybody shoots musical numbers as well as Bollywood.
It's the scale, isn't it? It's just the fact they will put, you know, 200-300 bodies in the, you know, in perfect synchronicity, beautiful saris, and
and the music is fun, and, it's very dance music, you know,
and there's a sort of campness to it. There's a sort of which I said to you, was sort of abandonment, you know what I mean? It's like, we're just having fun, and no one's kind of side-eyeing or being sort of wry about it.
Yeah, 100%. And that's the feeling I want to get. But what's great about Bollywood movies, too, is there's some quote that somebody said, I can't remember what it is. It's the gist of it is like a Bollywood movie is like just watching life, you know, because it's like they start out, they're really funny and they're corny, and then suddenly they're super heavy and they're crazy emotional, and then they're light again. And it's, I like that. I really like kind of that roller coaster ride of emotion. I find that really fun. If you do it right and it doesn't, you know, just become like maudlin, and then, but if there's a way to kind of keep that all in there. I mean, that's what I love about comedy is, you know, I never am drawn to do like straight comedy. I consider my movies to be kind of dramas that are funny, you know, because you need to make sure that the characters and the storyline and all that stuff mean something. You can't just go joke to joke.
We'll talk about Last Christmas, which is coming out on November the 15th.
In the 8th in the US.
Which is your love letter to London, which is a place that
yes.
You love and loves you back.
Yeah.
And your three-piece suits are a perfect adornment.
The only place I don't look like a weirdo.
That has a lot of social conscience to it. It's a movie which feels very rooted in the politics of now. So a slight departure.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the brilliant Emma Thompson wrote it, and Bryony Kimmings worked on the script. And, it's really got quite a social conscience because, you know, George Michael, whose music is featured in the movie, was kind of involved in the very beginning because Emma had talked to him about it, because the idea was he had come up like, make a movie based kind of loosely on the song Last Christmas. And when she was talking to him about it, he would, you know, he said like, oh, you know, I wish I could kind of include something about the homeless problem and all that, because that was a big issue for him. And so that's in there. So it's got a lot of people, a lot of good people's good intentions are in it. And it's just very sweet. Yeah, but it's different. It's not a hard comedy like I tend to do. Simple Favor was really fun for me in my previous movie because it was, a genre. I'm having more fun doing movies that aren't supposed to be comedies. You know what I mean? Even though Last Christmas is kind of supposed to be. Because I like to surprise people with comedy, you know. And that's, with Simple Favor was so much fun. We really marketed it like a thriller. Was it a mistake? Maybe we should have put more comedy in the marketing. I don't know. But, you know, you go, I know what this movie is going to be. And then so when something funny happens, you're like, oh, my God. But it comes out of character. It's not like suddenly somebody, you know, farts or, gets hit in the face with a pie. You know, but it's behavioral where you're like, oh, God, that's funny. Like, you know, this nerdy woman, she's so odd. And then, oh, my God, this, you know, other woman's so brash and bold and all that. And the comedy comes from that. That's really fun for me. And that's why this one was nice. Although this one, I think, has more of a feel of like, you go, oh, it's a romantic comedy, so you come in expecting it's going to be sort of light and fluffy, and then you get a whole second and third layer with this movie, which is really nice. But I think we balanced it. I feel like we balanced it really nicely.
So that's out November 15th.
15th, yeah, in the UK.
And when can we expect Monsters? I'm obsessed with Monsters.
I know, me too. Assuming my writing goes well, I'm hoping to get that in production, you know, early next year. And shoot it here in London. I'm writing it for London. So.
By which time you'll be hopefully a full-time resident.
Yes, that is my goal. That is our goal. My wife and I want to be full-time Londoners. So if you'll accept us, London.
I can't speak for all of London, only a tiny grey corner of the southeastern part in which I was born. But God, you are so, what a wonderful addition.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Fingers
Paul.
Fingers crossed. Thank you, Sue. You're the best.
A total pleasure. You're a darling.
You're one of my favourite people on the planet.
Likewise. Right back at you.
Thanks.
Love and thanks to the magnificent Paul. Last Christmas is out in the States on the 8th of November. It's out here in the UK on the 15th. If you have a review of this podcast, then why not post it to Apple Podcasts? And if you have a track that you'd like us to play as the opening soundtrack, whether it's something that you've made yourself, whether it's something you've found, whether it's something you think just deserves a wider audience, then why don't you email me at sue@audioboom.com. All I do, stare at the view. I'll be heading east to find my peace, where the desert feasts.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.